I can't believe how many people can't remember which side the life of Chanukiah is. I'm not going to ask you which side the light is on, because I've not found very good results so far. Whoever is lighting, first of all, you start on this side. Right? On this side. See the side that I'm on? It's in me. It's in me. Because I'm the letter here, so you start on my right side. Of course, each day it's one to the left of that. As opposed, however you do it. However you do it. You could do it like this, in which case I would have to start from this side. Okay? Because whoever likes it has to write it from the left side, from the right side. From the right side, setting it up from the right side. Although every candle is an additional one to the left. That's true. So ever so many people said to me, you start from this side. I think if there is a logical source of the mistake, that's an if there is a logical source of the mistake, the logic could be that here you are, I'm writing the Chanukiah, it looks to you like I'm writing it from the left side, right? From my perspective, I'm writing it from the right side. You're looking at it from where you are, it looks like I'm writing it from the left side, not from the right side. So that you might learn from that, when you go home, you'll write it from the left side. Well, or they look out the window. If this is true. You look at somebody's window, it's backwards. Yes, right? Because they should be lighting in their window from the perspective of the lighter who is lighting it, not from the perspective of the people who are outside.
That's why I would say, if this is planned to be written like this, shouldn't be, because it should be against the window,
if
you were doing it,
then
you'd be
the backwards
into it. So that
we would
all
be the same thing, correct? Right.
It would all be the same.
Okay, you want to do that? Let's do it that way. I'll take that. Except that I know there are people living here too.
We need to come to the
So that's the idea.
But
when
the
shaman
is facing
you, and
then the candle should be on
your side. No, I don't want to miss. Doesn't matter where the shaman is. Now, first you hear and recite the shaman, then you say the blessing, then you light the candle, then you say Amir Otavala, which I've also come, hardly anybody knows.
Yeah.
He didn't say.
Yeah.
So you'll finish out of a, it is very melody that we have always used for it. So you can have the scripture and the melody.
You also light the new candle first.
Thank you.
So what does Hanero Talalu mean? These candles which we light, all on these themes, are for the miracles, and on these laws, the wonders, all at you all, the deliverances, our milchamot, the battles, shasita mavontenu by anima, and this one was that, which you did on behalf of our ancestors in these days, at that and this time of the year. By your holy priests, the Hasmoneans, the Maccabees, were a priestly family. The whole Shmonat Shemei Chanukah, all 8 days of Chanukah, Hanero Talalu Kodeshim, these lights are holy. We have no permission to use them. Right? You can't use the Hanukkah lamps for any purpose other than for claiming God's miracles. Only to see them. In order to give thanks, to praise, your great name. Ami Secha, for your miracles, Ami Fotecha, for your wonders, Bar Yeshua Techa, and for your deliverance. Okay. That's a summary of the halacha, of the laws of the Chanukiah, that you're not allowed to use them. And that's why you have the Shabbos. That is the reason for the Shabbos. There's no need to have a Shabbos, except for the fact that you can't light from one of the lights to another light. Why? Because you're not allowed to make use of it. Or you're getting a benefit from it. You can't derive any benefit from this. It's there for one person, one purpose only. That's what? Yeah, well, that's public relations. So it's a claim of the miracles of God. I'm sure it was. And many chanukiyot also. Sometimes we have an oil chanukiyot, some of the old ones. The shamash is a very small one, just not too much oil. But it's also kind of difficult. But the one we have downstairs, the shamash, where we have it set up, you can't really tip the shamash. It's too difficult. So he's in combination with a candle. You blow the candle and the oil together. Because you light the shamash, then I take a candle, light the candle from the shamash, light the rest of it, and then I blow out the candle. Out the candle. So that's okay. You can do that too.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
So, first
Very good question. Talmud asked the same question. Talmud asked the same question. They've asked that question in Masechet Shabbat, where you have this discussion. And the answer is because Hanukkah doesn't come onto the scene until much, much after the time of the Torah. So generally, Yisrael Shekid Bishama means God commanded us in the Torah. So if you should have commanded us to do them. So the Talmud answers that God commanded us to listen to the edicts of the rabbis. Okay? And the rabbis instituted the lighting of the Chanukiah, and therefore we say Shekid Bishama indirectly. It's not direct, but indirectly, because the rabbis legislated this, and that is God's command to listen to the rabbis.
But this is different from, you know, the ones that we call it, the rabbis made rules to make a sense around it.
Right, this is not like that at all.
This is more,
this is innovative. This is innovative kind of legislation. Something was not there before. You have the story of Hanukkah in two places, really. It's in three places, two. It's in the Tribbles of the Maccabees, that being one place, which is in the Apocrypha, not part of our Bible. It is in the Talmud, in Masechet Shabbat, the section on it. And they actually cover different ground. The sections in the Maccabees speak about the politics of the Hasmoneans and the problems with the Greeks and the Antiochus Epiphanes and his edicts and the wars that were fought. Remember that all of this, made just passing reference to this in the Drasha around this last Shabbat, when I, at the end of it, set up a hypothetical. I'll say the hypothetical again for those of you who weren't there. I said that Judaism, as we know it, is really a religion that is a combination of the Bible and Greek culture. That we really have a Western religion. And it's Western, not because of the Bible, but because of what happened after the Bible. And it really is this story that's the turning point. Because this really is the product of the conquest of Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great, in about 300 BCE, conquered the entire Middle East. He was a Macedonian, conquered first of all the rest of Greece, and then moved east, so conquered all the Middle East. That is to say, the key areas are Turkey, Syria, and Egypt. And then this sliver of land that's between Syria and Egypt. It wasn't until after World War I that there was anything country called Syria. It never existed before. Syria was an area of that whole place. So that became a Hellenized piece of the world. Hellenized mainly. After Alexander died, He divided the empire, it was divided into two sons. One was Seleucus, was in Syria, and Ptolemy was in the south, in Egypt. So this whole story is the product of this. Because you know, the passage of time, you have tremendous tension, as the only thing, between the Syrian, whoever was in Syria, and then the leadership in Egypt. And the problem there is always the land bridge between the two. And that's the story of, you know who's there. We were there. You know? And not because there's anything essential, the land of Israel never really had all resources that the other places had. It's just a number. But it was an incredibly significant geographical location. This was right between these two empires. Because it turned into not one empire, but two empires. Which the same is true for the Romans. Why was it so important for the Romans? It's exactly the same. The Romans inherited all the Greek things. Basically the same issues. And the geopolitical issues never really changed all that much. So from the Greek perspective, from the perspective of what the Seleucid Greeks, Seleucus, the North, the Syrian Greeks, what they were doing was really just sort of trying to hold, to strengthen that empire. And they really wanted solid control in this area, which was where the land of Israel was. So this, you have a lot of this, you have explained now in the books of the Maccabees. It's not well known, because Jews don't read the book of Maccabees. If we're lucky, they read the Bible. We're lucky. If we're lucky, they read the Torah. The Torah, most people read, who care, because it comes to the synagogue. It just gets done for you. As long as you're not on the triennial cycle. You do it the old-fashioned way. And then there's one other source, which is called Megillat Ta'anit. Megillat Ta'anit, as mentioned in the Talmud, it was a Megillah that listed the times when one was not allowed to fast. Times when one was not allowed to fast. And as a result of that, we know about some of the festivals that existed in the rabbinic period, which don't have a real long history to them. In Hanukkah, it's a principle one. All the things in Megillat Ta'anit that still are in force, I don't remember them all, but Hanukkah, I think, is the only one, or the others are relatively insignificant. There are a whole lot of times which have to do with the celebration of a number of the military victories of one kind or another. Generally speaking, Jews don't do that. Was never a basic part of the way we instituted things, with the exception of Pesach, but that's not really a military victory, and the military side of that was played down tremendously. It's God's liberation of the people of Israel. So, in a way, this was the institution of Hanukkah, was Professor Elias Bickerman argued in his book, From Ezra to the House of the Maccabees. Was very incredible innovation, very innovative, because it was a rabbinic institution which innovatively took a military victory and declared it to be a national holiday. And that hadn't happened before. The only ones who did things like that were the Greeks. That's the beginning. See, the Greeks did things like that. We started doing them too. And in fact, the rest of the history of much of Jewry is that instead of going east, Jews went west. They went across North Africa, they went up to Rome, because of the geopolitics of things. So the Judaism really became a Western religion as a result of this long-term ramifications of these geopolitical realities. And to come back to what I said last Saturday, though, of course, one can never say, in looking at things historically, had they been different, because they never could have been different if they weren't different. One can speculate what would have happened had some progenitor of Genghis Khan really been the key player. I mean, had China moved faster and further into the Middle East, we would have a totally different religion. Not that the Bible would have been any different. The Bible would have been the Bible. but it would have been read through the perspective of Confucius and Buddha and all of those people, would have provided a very different context for what we know as Judaism. But that's not what happened. That's not what happened. It was very different what actually happened. And the truth is, you can't really learn all that much from speculation other than to enjoy the thought. The thought is an enjoyable thought. But I tell you that speculation, really, if you do speculation well, sells books. I heard one today. And the hottest thing going on right now, and you watch, you heard it here first, you're going to see this going to happen in the next, what?
Are you ready for this?
Yeah, you're right. Well, I'm putting a value judgment on it. I'm reporting, but I have a heavy value judgment on this. That is the next frame of intellectual argument about the events in the Middle East will go like this. It's already happening. It's not really news, but it's now formulated in books that are just getting out to the general public. It goes like this. The whole cause of the problems in the Middle East was the Versailles Treaty after World War I. And had the writers of that treaty been more reasonable, thoughtful, effective,
knowledgeable,
intelligent, so on, had they not been just drinking tea and gin with each other, the whole world would be completely different and a million times better. All the problems we have today are the result of that. And what I enjoy when you hear these things is that it's so easy to create a world that never was. to have in one's own mind that everything could have been so different. Nothing could have been different. Why? Because nothing was different. You know, the reality is, reality. And you can't just, as a result of our conspicuous hindsight, really effectively think about how things could have been better. Yeah, sure, they could have been better. As a result of what you learn, you know, each of us could do this with our own lives. If I only knew then what I know now, what I would have been able to do. Who has that? You know, the best you can do is study history and try not to make the same mistakes too many times. And just hope that by some chance you're not as confused as all the other people who ever lived before us. By some chance. I mean, there's not much chance of that, but maybe there's some chance. We can hope for that. But mark my word, that's going to be the new hot stuff about the view of what's coming.
What was the real role of the Treaty of Versailles? And, you know, she needs a serious account. She said, it was the problem, in large part.
Absolutely. But you're going to see that, and the way this is going to work itself out, of course, is that it will delegitimize the state of Israel. Because it will only tell part of the historical reality, and the historical reality is complicated, of course. Jews move in, Arabs move in, because Jews move in, Jews, other Jews move in, Arabs move out, they fight, you know, all kinds of stuff happens as a result of, you push one piece, and 30 different things happen.
And why do you know that specifically is coming to light now? What happened?
It's probably the Iraq War, to tell you the truth. It's what's going on now. And their realization, as this conversation that I heard today said, and it's probably true. Again, it's kind of thing that, of course, it's true, but you couldn't have predicted it a year ago. But when it happens, how could it not have happened? You know, we all should have known it. We should do so well playing the stock market also. So this one is I think he said what we're going to see happen now is a return to the reality that existed before World War I. Namely, the Balkans will, instead of being Yugoslavia, will be 5 or 6 different countries. And the Middle East, instead of being big countries, instead of having Iraq, you'll have 3 or 4 Iraqs.
They'll be Balkanized, exactly. So,
this may be true.
Yeah, I heard the same.
But this is today's wisdom, you know.
He also, I think, said that one of the reasons why they cut the Middle East up the way they did was in order to keep them subjugated.
Of course.
It was really the conquest of the end of 1815.
It all goes back to the Jews, actually, if you follow it far enough. I mean, this goes on all about. So, with all of this, I would take it with a grain of salt. If any of you have ever made decisions, you know that it's never easy to make decisions, and if you're right 55% of the time, you're probably doing pretty well. It's just an amazing thing. Because I remember, you know, when you know, I see it from a very limited perspective, a rabbi's perspective, once in a while I have to address some issues, you know, and so I laugh at myself because I know how hard I work to try and figure out a point of view to share with other people. If you have a pulpit, you have to, you know, take it seriously, you do those things, and then, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, since you know so much more about things that you didn't know as much about several years before, you say, well, you know, if I knew then what I know now, I'm not sure I would have said what I said then. But, you know, it's just for all of us.
Yeah,
I
mean, we did a lot better because we understood how damaging it was what we've done after World War One, in terms of essentially the revenge.
I hope you're right.
And the reconstruction of Japan were profoundly different than what was done after World War I.
What's the difference between the Warsaw and the Tiananmen Treaty?
I couldn't tell you. Tiananmen, I don't know what it is. You've got work to do when you get home. Stay at home. Stay at home. Okay, we are on Daf Dalad Amud Bet 4b2, left hand side of the page. Yeah. Now, if you remember, they come to the conclusion at the end of our last class, after having skirted around in an interesting dance, where we were in quest of a scriptural verse from which we could learn that money is a form of making kiddushin. And although we had learned that at the very beginning of the Talmud that we're studying this year, we saw that this subject was really placed before us for analysis in all of its logical possibilities, in terms of its logical possibilities. And there was a verse that was used that was a verse that in the Torah itself refers to a woman who had been sold into a type of servitude, namely a young girl. The father had sold her into this servitude to be a shikha ivriya, a Hebrew maidservant, and that there was a process whereby she would get out of that. It was a process, among other things, where she would become a nara. She would become a nara, which meant that she would turn 12. Automatically, then, she was released from that servitude. And the Torah said, V'yatz'ah, and she shall go out chinam, without any payment. And the Talmud understood the force of that to be, she shall go out as a nara without any payment to the master, the slave master. But she shall, in other circumstances, where going out, namely where there's a change of her status, there is a payment. There is a payment. And that payment, instead of, in the one case we learned that one master doesn't get the payment, in another case we learned that the other master does get the payment, and who is the master? Who is the master of the Nara? It cannot be the slave master. There's only one person, in fact, who has any control over her, and that is her father. Oh, if we learn that her father, in fact, gets a payment, what payment are we talking about? Oh, that's the payment of Kiddushin. Aha! We have learned that Kiddushin has a source in the Torah. No, it was sort of through a dreidel that we learned that. I mean, I don't see how you could learn that by reading it. You just follow what I said. No spinning dreidel does a better dance than what I just said. Certainly not as obvious. Certainly not obvious. So then the Talmud went into another possibility, which we skipped, in fact, which was a Kal v'chomer argument. If we say in one circumstance we have three different forms of acquisition, and if we learn from one, if we could learn from another, and maybe you could learn from that, it's logical that we could come to the conclusion also that you need this first. That you use money for kiddushin. And then the Talmud said, we concluded, we said, well, if that's true, if it's so logical, what do we need the verse for? And then, of course, we then had another verse, the verse that we started with, ki yikach ish isha, if a man takes a woman. And we said, yikach, take, doesn't mean take. Yikach means just as it meant in the story of Abraham, where he acquired, took some land from Ephraim the Hittite for kesef. So yikach means kesef. When it says ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes a woman for a wife, it means acquires her by going through a kinyan, a form of acquisition which has kesef as one of its possible forms. And then the Talmud says, or maybe it didn't say it yet, let's say, I think it said it yet. You see? Maybe? No, I think I said it last time. I'll just finish up with that, since something that I did get it right last time. The Talmud then says, well, if you have a verse, what do we need the logical reasoning for? He says, well, that's right. You're right. So it finally came down, after all this discussion, that the verse was key. After it sat on the verse, and we found a good verse, it was a pretty clear verse. It wasn't 100% obvious because it said ki kach ki shisha, and I needed another source where I had a gzerah shavah. I had two sources, both of which talked about both taking and money. Okay, I could compare one to the other, but that's pretty good as far as these things go. It's probably pretty good. Now, that's where we pick up. Now the Talmud says, "Itzarich lemichta v'yatzachinam." Oh, so you started this whole discussion by citing the source in the Torah of a woman who goes out, a young girl who is sold into slavery. Okay, she was sold, and there was money, and the money finally we learn from that goes not to the slave master but to the father. That is to say that there is money involved in kiddushin, in making a marriage. But you finally came to the conclusion that you don't need that verse. Because the only good conclusion you came to was that the verse, ki kach ish isha, when a man takes a woman for a wife. That was the verse that you learned it from. So now the Talmud says, so what do we need the first verse for? Right? We did have half a chance with that first verse, even though it was quite a great old. You had half a chance. So what do we need it for at all? That's what it's asking now. To each the Lechem Mechtar, and we really needed that first verse which reads the Yatachinam. She goes out without any payment to the slave master. Why? No, and then it says, Eat the Lechem Mechtar Ki Kachisha. And we also need the second source where it says, when a man takes a woman for a wife. Mm-hmm. And we need both those sources, the Talmud says. Mm-hmm. And now it will explain to us why. Had the Torah only written when a man takes a woman for a wife, which was the conclusion that we finally came to, we like that source, had it only written that, Hava Anini Kiddushin Diahavla Baal Bidahavu, I would have said that the money of Kiddushin that a Nara receives from her husband is hers. Right? Anara, 6 months from the time a woman turns 12, the time that she's 12 and a half, 6 months. Let's say she does enter into Kiddushin. The father, in fact, has the right to give her away or not to give her away. He has to be agreeable to this, which is not the case after 12 and 6 months. So there's 1 6-month period of time, sort of a transition period for her and her maturity. Right? I would have said then, if it just says, ki kach ishisha, when a man takes a woman for a wife, then he has to give the woman the money. And the money would have gone to this woman who's 12 years and 3 months old. And she would get it. Oh, katav rachmane v'yatza chinam. Therefore, the Torah reads v'yatza chinam. We needed that whole discussion in order for us to learn that during that 6 month period of time, it is the father who keeps the money for the kiddushin and not the woman. Okay? It's an odd situation, but that's what we learned from this verse. And therefore, we needed the verse to teach us something that was relevant in the laws of marriage. Right? And the Torah only taught us the statement, the Atachinam, and we learned this whole thing from that verse about the slave. Hava amina hecha diya va ihi ledide vikidashto. Havu kiddushe. I would have said that where a woman gives money to a man and she betroths him, so that kiddushin is valid. Oh, that's an interesting possibility. If it was just the issue of passage of money from the hands of one person to another, then maybe that's all. It just has to be the passage of money from the hands of one person to another. And let's say she gives him the money. What's wrong with that? Okay? Maybe that's the law. Oh, for that, when he takes a woman for a wife, v'lo ki tikach, and not when she takes, it's when he takes. Therefore, the law is that, in fact, he has to give her the money. She can't give him the money. Well, I'll tell you the truth. This has been an issue. You'll see it. It'll probably come up again in the Talmud. It's actually an issue in our modern Jewish wedding ceremony. Any of you who are sensitive to the, you know, we have a desire, which may have peaked, actually, but there's been a desire over the last while to mutualize the Jewish wedding ceremony. For example, the introduction of a double ring ceremony, the double ring ceremony, which we've been doing, probably for about, 50 years, max. More? 50 years? Really? You had a double ring ceremony? You were innovative. Interesting. I knew you were always innovative. The double ring ceremony was an attempt to create, you know, he gives her the ring, that makes the condition. Then to make it nice, she gives him the ring. I remember when I got married, I was married by an Orthodox rabbi, who was at the time number two man at Yeshiva University. So I had no expectation that we were going to have a double ring ceremony. So he said to me, I remember we went to the rabbi, and the rabbi said, would you like a double ring sandwich? Really killed off. I couldn't believe it. Here was number two man in Yeshiva University asking me, the young rabbinical student at the conservative rabbinical seminary, well, I wanted a double ring sandwich. So even, you know, it had obviously made its way into even that world. The double ring ceremony is an interesting ceremony. What do you say when you have the double ring ceremony? When you have the first ring, and he gives her the ring, you say, Hare at nekudeshet li betabad zo kadat Moshe Yisrael. With this ring, I be led according to the law of Moses and Israel. Okay, that's what you say. But for any of you who have been at weddings at which I have officiated, know that when we do the second ring, I do not change the gender. We say, Ani ledodi ledodi li. Ani ledodi ledodi li. Okay, that's the way I do it. Why? Because of what we just read. Ki yikach ish isha. The man actually makes the kinyan with the woman and not the other way around. In order not to blur that, we don't use the same formula. Some people have felt that because that obviously is inequitable, it's not the same thing. There's a lack of, as you said, parsimony there. Parity, not that parsimony. Parity is a lack of fact. Maybe parsimony is, but the lack of parity.
You're on the right track.
Lack of parity, you know, that all has to be the same. Well, that's surely a way of looking at these things, but surely not the way that some of us look at it. Rather, we're trying to do certain things, but not to change the very central nature, which, as you can see now, one of the things to keep in mind here is the wonder, the extent to which marriage law is based on logic. I mean, behind the arguments that we are seeing is an implicit notion that perhaps this area of the law either can or should or lends itself to the logical development of custom. Notice, I think, from what we are seeing, that while that is raised as a possibility, every single time it is raised, it is destroyed. In fact, marriage law has its structure from roots in tradition and not from logic. It has its structure in roots that has a basis in tradition. I don't want to exactly go so far as to say that it's a commandment from God to Moses and Mount Sinai, because I actually don't have data for that. And when you give the ring, you don't say, Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Asher Kiddushanu L'Mitzvotav. You say, all right, you're in the Tzoriot. And they're a rabbinic mitzvah. You don't say any of those things. That's not exactly clear. So I couched my words carefully the way I just said it. It has its roots in tradition as opposed to being the creative development of logic. Okay? Which is not to say you can't have any creative development, but the essence of the thing has got to have its roots in tradition. And that's a very, those are really two different ways of looking at things. And that's how I read our passage. And you'll see this happen in each of these forms. We're going to go through a process now. The process will be, this makes sense. Why couldn't we learn it logically from something else? And you'll see that logic fails for a variety of possibilities. So I'm of the view that, in fact, there won't logic that fails. It may be absolutely logical. The whole place of logic is really second to the striving to root things in tradition. That, in fact, marriage is really tradition. And that is one of its sources of strength.
Because Kedat Moshe refers
to Kedat Moshe to Israel refers to you. That's a good point. You say, Hare at Mekudeshet Li, you are betrothed to me. Mekudeshet means the Erisim. Here, this first part of the ceremony. Betaba'ato with his ring. Kedat Moshe the Israel, according to the law of Moses and Israel. So what does it mean? Kedat Moshe the Israel? It means all of these things that we just read. It means the traditions as we have them in here in the Talmud, in effect, and everything that develops since, of course, and you know that is possible.
Why do you say that?
Does anybody know where the tradition of the name came from?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose it was Jewish. I wonder whether, in fact, the Jewish tradition borrowed from something else and sort of tacked on the ring to the concept of affection. Most, I think when people think of a ring, it's a form of attachment.
Correct.
It's not a form of acquisition.
Correct. Correct. I don't know the answer to that. I did start doing that research, but I never finished it. My hunch was, where I could find it was, in a volume, in a series of volumes that are now up, I think, to the eighth volume of Professor Schreiber of the Feinman University, called Minhagei Yisrael. Minhagei Yisrael. The Customs Edition. And he studies all these things and tries to do historical research to tell us where they come from. My hunch was that if it's anywhere, it's probably there. But I hadn't had the time to go through all the volumes. It doesn't take all that much time. I still haven't done it, because the answer may be that he didn't do that piece of work here. I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know the answer. Yes.
I would take a guess that in Roman times, in Greek times, the ring on a person was a sign of kingship. Olive trees bore the rings of the master.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time they were worn around the neck, but other times they were worn other places. Other places. So I don't know. You know, I mean,
I don't know.
It could be.
Well, you know,
there is that idea of ownership, the ring.
I just don't know, because you have rings in the Bible, not for that purpose. You have a ring in the Bible. you have rings, decorative rings, that you have for that purpose, definitely. Nose rings, earrings. Probably.
Decorative nose rings.
Yeah. Bracelets. Probably some of them refer to finger rings also. But you also have the notion in the Bible of the chotenet. That's the signet ring. The signet ring is in the Bible, and that is a clear use of a ring for a purpose. And whether that's in any way related to what you're just saying, no, I honestly don't know. But I know you do have that in the text.
I think it's interesting that it focuses on Moses, the law of Moses, which is the form of relations. So many other things we harken back to the patriarchs and the matriarchs.
Mm-hmm.
And here certainly marriage harkens back to the patriarchs and matriarchs.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we don't extend back to there. And I guess that's to formalize the legal nature of the relationship rather than the tradition.
I think that's correct. Plus the legal nature, you're seeing an effort to root that in the tradition, standing in the words of the Torah. I think you're absolutely right that as a practical institution, institutions are constructed in order to recognize and give strength to the legal nature of the thing and the legal, the legal institutions that exist and their antiquity.
And maybe also not to condone polygamy.
How did you say that? How did you say that? Oh, because work a little bit. Interesting. So, good. Interesting.
Yes.
If the order of law came after Moses, and that would be the mission, why do we look for having defined support for more than missionaries?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have to look through scripture, through scripture for support? Why, if it was handed down by Moses, why don't we just
take it the way it is?
Yeah.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I can give you as much of an answer as I think logically we're able to give to a question like that. Once you have a tradition of an oral law, of the oral law, there's something good and something bad about that. The good thing is that it's an oral law. It's passed down orally. It has certain strength to it because it's part of the oral tradition. That's also the problem, because human nature is such that human nature wants to also see a written form of the same thing. At an early stage of the game, at the stage even of the Mishnah itself, the oral law was not written down. Even the Mishnah itself had its edited form. It was probably not because it was a written edited form, but because it was an edited form of an oral work. Certainly it existed in some written forms as well. Those were called Megillot, which were written forms. But I think it's almost human nature, and that's what you see therefore taking place in the Talmud. The Talmud will say, well, what is this law? And then the interesting thing happens right afterwards. When the rabbis try to root a law in the written law, it poses a problem for the rabbis who come in the next generation. That problem is, are they just playing a game to try and find something to pin this on? And it's just the way these things work themselves out. They're just trying to create relationships, maybe for memory reasons, or maybe because there is an implicit something of the Torah itself, that everything comes from the Torah. The Torah is wondrous, the Torah is miraculous, the Torah has everything in it, and you know, that's what gives energy and force to this process. Or are the rabbis really just discovering something? You know, and this is part of exegetical discovery, and therefore when they do this, it's part of the development of the law, and it's a rabbinic product, and you should learn from that. Therefore the rabbis have developed an idea. But the truth is, in most cases, they don't have the answer to that question. There was a good Professor Alberg, who wrote a scientific edition of the Mishnah, also wrote in Mavola Mishnah. He was a professor at the Hebrew University. And he has a chapter in his Mavola Mishnah, the introduction to the Mishnah, to try and analyze this problem. And he says, sometimes you can come to a conclusion, because the rabbis will sort of give you enough evidence that you can see that maybe they have a new problem and they're trying to find, like any lawyer or any judge, trying to find something in the law that comes before it that gives us something to go on as we develop the law. Maybe that's what they're doing. And maybe that's not what they're doing. It's really hard to tell.
Just sort of another question. Why would that, for example, in what we're studying now, why wouldn't a scriptural source always then have precedence or priority over something of logic? I mean, for example, what we're doing here, why don't, once you find a decent scriptural source, why don't you sort of just leave it at that?
Right. So the answer probably is, there's a speculation on my part, the fact that they don't leave it at that means that they really didn't treat it as a scriptural source. That it was sort of in a never-never land between, and they wondered, does this have a scriptural source? Does this not have a scriptural source? How scriptural is a scriptural source? Is this God's word to Moses on Mount Sinai, or is this some development from it? From the evidence in front of us, my reading of it is that they're not actually sure. Because if they were sure, I would agree with you. If they were sure, they just wouldn't do this. They would have stopped before that. And the fact that they don't stop before it is, I would argue, evidence that they're really not sure. That they're trying to work that question out. And one of the things that we're seeing here, I'm not even sure whether I have a conclusion if they're working that out. Because when it comes down to it, and they finally get a source, I'm not sure whether, I have to look this up and see what Maimonides does. Maybe when we're partying, I'll look at Maimonides, because it should be over there. But I'm trying to think whether Maimonides counts this as one of the 613 mitzvot. Ki kach ish isha. That means that money is the form of kiddushin. When Maimonides counts and lists the 613 commandments, is that, that I just said, that money is, that when you want to make kiddushin, you make it through money. Is that one of the 613 commandments? I would bet the answer is no. I would bet the answer is no, because Maimonides, I would think, sensitive to the very things we're sensitive to here. He probably will say something like, ki tach ishisha, that there is a form of marriage, or that a man should initiate the marriage. But I'd have to actually see what Maimonides says. That's where you go with these things. You want to see whether somebody like Maimonides actually counts that verse the way we understand it, the way we've come to conclude that it has meaning here, whether he considers that to be God's word to Moses on Mount Sinai. Because he's read this stuff too. And it would be interesting to see, but I bet he does. Maybe I'm wrong. Well, it doesn't affect us here, because the same procedures would take place in the second marriage. That's not going to be any different. The way you make one marriage is the way you make two, or ten. They're all made the same way. The only difference between the first marriage and the second marriage, if we're talking about assuming that the woman, that this is her first marriage. We're talking in those terms. A man has more than one wife. Huh? The only difference between the first and the second is actually the ramifications of the ketubah. Because the ketubah is a protection for the wife. Ketubah is, in case there is a dissolution of the marriage, and the marriage can be dissolved in two ways, either by the death of the husband or by divorce. We learned that in the first Mishnah. Right? Here, think of this problem. You'll see why the ketubah is important. He has to write her a ketubah for 200 zuz. Okay? So it's a statutory ketubah. That's a fair amount of money. If you think, v'zabi naba bitre zuz echad gad ya. V'zabi naba bitre zuz echad gad ya. So with two zuz, you bought one goat. So in effect, the amount of money that's involved here is 100 goats. That's a fairly substantial amount of money. I mean, every Joe Schmo has a ketubah for 100 goats. That's a lot of goats. There's a lot of money in there, right? It's a lot. So just think of that. So the problem is, in theory here, in polygamy, the guy dies. Let's say the guy dies, right? And he owns 200 zoos of property. Who gets the property?
Yes, if
I do, you need to share
with the subordinate.
Here you go. The question is, he already made an agreement with the first wife for 200 zoos. If the second one enters the picture, does she then vitiate the first agreement? Because that was a contract. They made a contract. What?
If she buys up his will. If she buys only in case he wants to be divorced.
No, it's also in case. It's also if he does. It's not in fact a will, it's a promissory note. Not a will, it's a promissory note. Because it gets paid before the will gets paid. The will gets paid, the statutory payment goes to the children and not to the spouses. Okay, that's one of the reasons, according to the Torah, that's the nature of the passage of the inheritance. It goes to the children. So the ketubah protects the wife because she gets paid before the will gets paid. See, the law eventually realized that she was put in a difficult position. So the ketubah then protects her. The problem with two wives is what if he only has enough money to pay one wife? Does the second wife have a claim on the first wife? Right? That's why you shouldn't have two wives. Is that a nice... All I can tell you is probably there was very little of it. But these issues are discussed in detail as at least theoretical issues, because they are issues of contract law. They are discussed in the Talmud.
Did Judaism actually make the rules abolishing polygamy, or was that
yes.
a national
issue? No, that was made by Rabbi Rabbeinu Gershom, who was a rabbi in Germany in the 10th century, the 900s. So it was not abolished legally until then. However, the problem was that not all the Jews knew about Rabbeinu Gershom. They didn't know about it. Among the five, no, it's just the nature of communication. We didn't have, how do people learn? So where there was an obvious way to learn things, namely in North Africa, things were fine. Trade between Italy to Germany, or from Germany to Italy to North Africa. That was easy. So that everybody in the Sephardi world, more or less, from North Africa to Baghdad, eventually got the message. But there were frankly Jews who didn't know the message. They lived in Yemen. That's why when the Yemenites came to Israel, they never learned about the law of Rabbeinu Gershom. And it net, because from the 10th century till the 20th century, 10 centuries went by, it never affected them. So that was the problem the Israelis had to deal with, was the problem, there was still polygamy into the 1950s. I don't know whether any of these people still alive, but the Israelis did what you do in those situations, to grandfather people in. Basically, they grandfathered everybody who came on Aliyah with more than one wife, you could keep the wife, but you couldn't add to that life. It's a problem also in the state of Israel with the Arabs, because the Arabs have polygamy. So that it's an issue among the Israeli Arabs whether the state of Israel can really have a law against polygamy, because some of the Arabs are polygamists.
And what authority was Rabbi Gershom, and what was
that? It was just an authority. He was a well-accepted authority of the Ashkenazi rabbi.
There's still polygamy in Africa now.
Plenty of places in the world. There's polygamy in Utah,
yeah,
let alone Africa.
There were many women, because 10,000 men died in the world, right? Many women left with no potential husbands, so the government really considered.
To
also bring checks, you know, the one for some reason it was to bring.
What does that check mean? C-Z-E-C-H?
Czechoslovakia. Young Jews from Czechoslovakia to bring them maybe to, but most of the issues were killed. I think it was very clear.
Sounds like they made a good decision. Let's go on a little bit further. A little bit further. They've got guns from Czechoslovakia, and they've got whips from Czechoslovakia, and they've got sheds from Czechoslovakia also. Today it's turned around. Okay, now we learned, therefore, what we have learned, remember the point now, is that we do have a source in Scripture. That source is the accepted source. Even though I'm not sure exactly what the force of that is, but that is the key thing. Now, we're going to move to the next issue, which is sex. Because remember, it was the second of the methods of acquisition was sexual relations. Sexual relations. Be'ala. He had sexual relations with her. Okay? So, now, the Gemara says, Uve Allah. When the Torah talks about marriage, among the things it says is Uve Allah, and he shall have sexual relations with her, or he has had sexual relations with her. Now, if you take the note number 17, go down there, and you have the full quote of this verse, Ki Kachisha. And we just finished with that. When a man takes a woman for a wife, he kach ich ishisha. We learn from that money is a form of kiddushin. Says the phone, ki kach ishisha, uviyala. When a man takes a woman for a wife, uviyala, and has sex with her. Okay? So that's a pretty good sense. We know that it's talking about marriage. It says, ki kach ishisha. Right after that, it says, uviyala. So we said it, sex is key to marriage. Okay? Vaya in lotin sachem deina. Then it goes on really to talk about something else, which is divorce. Interesting to mix the two. The very source we have of marriage is a verse that starts by talking about marriage. A man marries a woman, then he has sex with her. And then it goes on to say he doesn't like her, finds in her irvat davar, whatever that means. V'chadav la sefer kritut, and he shall write for her a bill of divorcement. And atan b'yadam, he shall place it in her hand, b'shilcha mibetel, and he shall let her go out from his house. Okay? So that, the latter part clearly refers to the divorce, the first part refers to marriage. So here it said, uviyala, yes, that's a good biblical source. A good biblical source. And of course, what does the Talmud do? The Talmud says, V'halo dinhu. No, what do we need a biblical source for? This is logical. We could have derived this idea from logic. Right, that's the way we started. Notice the methodology. This is a repetitive methodology. Is there a problem with the way?
Yes.
4B2. 4B2 on the right side of the page. Top. Okay? Yilamed. This teaches that a woman may be acquired through cohabitation. And the Gemara says, the whole lo dinu, what do we need the verse for? This is logical. And look at the logic. Uma yivama she'en nitnei t'chasef. We know as far as a yivama goes, remember that's the levirate marriage we made reference to before? That's when a man dies, has no children, has a brother. The brother then has to marry the woman. So how does he marry her? Interestingly enough, he does not marry her by giving her kekes. How does he marry her? Sex. He has relations with her. It is the act, the sexual act, that makes her his wife. So it says, Uma yibamasha ein nikneh pekesef. In the case of the yivama of the levirate marriage, where the woman is acquired, is not acquired through kesef, through any money. Money is not a part of any transaction. There's no change of status symbolized by the getting of something of value. Nikmet bidia, she is acquired through sex. Zoshin nikmet b'kesef. A woman who, in fact, we know from what we just learned in the Talmud, is acquired through money. Isn't it logical that that woman should be acquired also with sex? In other words, sex is the more serious thing. What's the big deal with money? Money, you just get a little bit of money, you get a wife. No, sex, we're talking about something serious. So if we say in a case where a woman can be acquired, namely the levirate marriage. They're acquired through sex, right? And there's no money involved. In regular marriage, where we already have proven that money is involved, money can do it, obviously sex can do it. Not so obvious, but that's what the argument is. Right? Sex can do it. All right, so now that Mara tries to tell us, it's not as obvious as you think. No, the Hebrew maids, this Hebrew slave, you see, this keeps coming up. That person will prove that this reasoning is false. Shinikneit b'kesef, a slave is acquired by money. The Eina ain nicknamed the Diya, but she's not acquired by sex.
By you. The wife.
You're jumping ahead, but Mama says the same thing. Right. At this stage of the game, the Gemara is arguing simply logically. You are arguing if somebody is acquired by money, then surely they could be acquired by sex. So the Gemara says, well, how about the female slave? She is acquired by money, but she's not acquired by sex. So obviously the logic doesn't work the way you think it works. Just to say because you have one doesn't mean that the other is logical. So then the Gemara goes on and it says, Mala amaha ivriyasha ein kinyana l'shum ishu. What are you comparing the two for? A Hebrew slave is a slave. You can't have sex with her. That's different. That's called marriage.
Right?
That's, when you're talking about sex, that means she serves you, but she doesn't have sex with you. Right? Unless you had thought otherwise. Right? This, whatever this relationship is of the maidservant, does not involve a sexual relationship. So it says, yeah, how can you compare the two? Which is just what you said, Ron. You can't compare these two. You're saying you're learning from one about the other. There's something that you can't compare one to the other. You mean to draw some conclusion about a woman in a normal marriage situation, which of course is with sex? Sex is as basic to marriage. You can't. There's no logic there. All right? So then the Talmud concludes, Talmud Amar Uvi Allah. Best thing is the scriptural source. The back to a verse. And the logic just didn't do as well as a verse. Which is not to say that we're finished with this. But you can see the way these things are done. An effort is made to prove something logically. Comparison is made. Is this as logical as you think it is? It's shot down. We're back to the verse.
I'm going to say that because you have the verse. And we don't need the verse because it's logical. Then it says, no, it isn't logical because of the comparison with the maidservant. But they conclude by saying, yes, it is logical because the maidservant's reputation is irrelevant.
Here, look at the English. I think it does a good job here. It says, Wright objects to this answer, which is to say, there's the Kal Vachomer, right? There's a Kal Vachomer here. And then Wright comes, Mala Ama, what comparison could be made to a Hebrew maidservant who is not acquired for the sake of marriage? Can the same be said of this woman who in Kiddushin is acquired for the sake of marriage? You tried to make a comparison. Your comparison is not good. You try to make a logical conclusion. A logical conclusion is not good. No?
No. They're saying the logic is the Yavama, who cannot be acquired by money, but can be acquired by cohabitation. Therefore, it's logical that when you can be acquired by money, of course you can also be acquired by cohabitation. That's the Kal Vachomer.
Correct.
So comes a refutation based on the maidservant.
Correct.
Is rejected. The manipulation is rejected.
Correct. The refutation of
the Kal Vachomer, of the first principle based on the Yavama.
Somebody tried to. Right.
Now, the example is
somebody tried to refute it, but they couldn't refute, their example is bad, so then.
That's right.
So the Kal Vachomer stands, you're saying.
Yeah.
That's correct.
The Kal Vachomer
stands, correct?
Is that saying, because this is correct, it says the tenth, since the case of the maidservant is not comparable, the original Kal Vachomer still stands, the Yavama, and may be applied to deduce the validity of Kiddushin through cohabitation.
Correct.
So why do we move the verse?
You're right, which is why it goes on. So, you're correct. But the Kal Vachomer still may make sense here. But the other side says, no, we still have a verse, and so we can't be finished with this. Okay, we'll go on. Yeah.
Didn't you have a ketubah? The first time they read
right
here, she already had a ketubah. Right. She already did that.
Well, that actually will sort of be raised coming up, because the question is whether that first marriage was really kinyan to the second marriage. That's implicit in what you're saying, that if she did have some form of kinyan, maybe we can say that the second marriage is really the first marriage, or it's like an extension of the first marriage or something, and she doesn't need a new kinyan. Correct, that's going to come up soon. Ladies and gentlemen, let us party a little bit. Certainly this. Very good. Thank you.